Welcome all to a Wednesday evening with Clear Mountain.
Hi, John.
So today we're going to talk about Hermann Hesse, and it is pronounced Hess. We just
Check.
looked it up right now, finally. So if you gain nothing else in this live stream, you've got that.
It's not Hesse, it's not Hesse.
It's Hess. So for those of you who don't know, Hermann Hesse wrote Siddhartha, Narcissus and Goldmund, The Glass Bead Game. He won the Nobel Prize for Literature. And Siddhartha in particular was kind of an impetus for a lot of monks I know and nuns to ordain, or at least to get into Buddhism initially. And it has been a huge influence in the culture and the zeitgeist in terms of kind of bringing people onto the spiritual path, usually in their late teens or mid-teens, I find. So, Ajahn, would you summarize Siddhartha for us so that we can kind of get a picture of it?
Oh, like the word zeitgeist, which you just used. What Siddhartha is it's a whole genre called Bildungsroman, which is basically a coming of age tale, as is Damien and Steppenwolf and Glass Bead Game. But Siddhartha, it is the Buddha's first name in the Pali Canon, but in this book by Hermann Hesse, it is not the Buddha. It's just the son of a Brahmin, so unlike the Buddha, but born contemporaneously with the Buddha, so set in the time of the Buddha in India. And it's the story of how he kind of became disillusioned with his Brahmin upbringing, similar to Gautama Buddha, and then went in search of something different. And he ends up going out and living with these samanas. So there's a lot of similar wording from the Pali Canon. And yeah, goes, lives with these samanas, practice all these austerities, and then eventually feels like that's not the way. He meets the Buddha, so the historical Buddha meets Siddhartha Gautama, who's just called Gautama in this book, and is impressed. And his friend, who he left home with, Govinda, ends up following the Buddha. They go different ways, and Siddhartha, the protagonist of this story, then just continues his way. He says he wants to find his own way. And then so he goes and lives, well, finds a courtesan named Kamala, which means lotus, and basically learns the ways of love. He apprentices and learns the way of trade and basically becomes somewhat or very corrupted by a life of gambling and excess in different ways. And eventually leaves that life, has a dream of Kamala and how she ages, and is just, disenchanted and realizes that there's more to look for. So he leaves and ends up, coming back to this ferryman and this river, which he had encountered before he met Kamala, and then learns the ways of the river. Learns all that the river can teach him, and then it's hinted becomes enlightened. The word enlightenment isn't really well defined, but basically, at the end of the story, I won't give the total. I won't be a spoiler, but it's hinted that he's become enlightened in whatever that means in this context. So.
So what did the book mean to you when you first read it or on this most recent pass, what kind of jumped out?
So different answers to those two questions. I mean, it's not a long book. I listened to the audio version of it twice in the last month. It's just 4 hours, actually, depending on the translation. But first time around was just reading it probably in late teens, and read it about the same time as I read The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. And actually, I don't think I finished Siddhartha. I think I got to the part where he goes and meets Kamala, and I was like, all right, yeah, he's just finding his way, and all the sensuality, that's kind of be the path. And admittedly, Hermann Hesse, that's not the end of the story. It's not just a total path of hedonism and sensuality, which is, I guess, all I had the patience for reading to in late high school, but it was a book of search. I mean, that was this, you know, buildings room and this search for coming of age. And I was definitely feeling the first part of Siddhartha's life, where he leaves the palace. Definitely feel like, you know, middle class upbringing. And it doesn't take too long to look and see that that's not, you know, the total be all and end all of spiritual progress. So is there anything better? And that's what this book kind of took me in the direction of. So.
Were you, did you go from there to the monastery pretty immediately, or was
no,
it a want
I went from there in the direction of Kamala, I think, pretty directly. And yeah, that book in tandem, I mentioned the electric Kool-Aid acid test, which actually had a sort of a bigger influence on me just because it was more modern. You know, Siddhartha was written, published in 1922. And yeah, electric Kool-Aid acid tests, maybe late 60s or 70s, Tom Wolfe's account of the Merry Pranksters, and basically just about hippies and idealizing hippie life and a basically spiritual progress through indulgence and yeah, just living all you can live, you only live once type of mentality. So, and then just seeing the excesses of that and how that doesn't lead to ultimate happiness or even really much mundane happiness. That fairly quickly led me to a monastery. So yeah, after a year and a half or so and a Goenka retreat.
But that's shorter than Siddhartha's sojourn. So
yeah, it was. I think he was with the Samanas for about 3 years, then met the Buddha and only spent like one night with him. And then goes off to find Kamala. What about for you? What was the place of Siddhartha in your spiritual biography?
Yeah, I think we probably have to give a trigger warning on this live stream for people to say that, you know, on one level, I love this book. It was my first real vision of the Buddha. I read it when I was 15, and there was kind of this sense of golden light and the Christians call them moments of grace. It's like when you step into a footprint that was made for you. And like you said, it's a book of search, but it was also my first real vision of what a monastic was. Even though he only spends a day with the Buddha, there was something deep, deeply resonant about that. And it was interesting because and I started to meditate. That was when I started to meditate every day. And so people on this live stream, I'm sure, will be in love with this book. I was and am still. And I remember reading a New Yorker article where they dismissed Hesse's writing as naive, and because it's so simple. And I thought that was really cheap, a cheap way to dismiss it, because his writing is archetypal. It's so pure, and I think in Damien, in Narcissus and Goldman, in Siddhartha, he articulates like this real dichotomy in the spirit that people feel of like, do I, you know, pull back or go into the world? You know, do I stick with conventions? Or those two forking pathways away from the mundane reality, which we all find ourselves, you know, living. And yet what is so interesting is that, Hesse's answer to that search, which he articulates so vividly, is actually pretty not Buddhist. You know, it's, you know, in the end, Siddhartha goes into the sensual realm, and in the electric Kool-Aid acid test he does too, and the Dharma bums of Jack Kerouac, like there's this whole, I feel like, moment in American intellectual and spiritual history where like there really was this search imminent, and this rebellion against kind of this cookie cutter existence that came out of perhaps World War II or World War I or just that whole era. I mean, I think there's this constant struggle. And yet what, you know, in this idea, like to pull people out of the quagmire, you have to be in the quagmire or in the gutter to pull people out of the gutter or something like that. And yet it's interesting to read Steppenwolf, which is his book later, and it's sort of autobiographical, and you get the sense of kind of a sad, lonely old man. And I know you'd spoken about a similar trajectory with the Kool-Aid, electric Kool-Aid acid test with the authors of that. But what's so interesting is, you know, the Buddha really did praise a certain amount of discipline and training. And like, there does come a point where you can exist in the world without being caught by it, but most of us are not there yet. And so, yeah, I think it was a beautiful book to read then. And as I've practiced, I think I've gained a bit of a different perspective on it. Yeah.
Yeah, that, it is interesting. I mean, you know, Siddhartha has more spiritual, much more spiritual nuance than the electric Kool-Aid acid test, or than a just a hedonistic life of gratification and happiness through pleasure. Mm. I mean, he does, there is a moment of, I believe it's phrased as awakening. I'm not sure if the original German, but before he goes and meets Kamala, you know, after he, I believe after he sees the Buddha, you know, he has this moment of awakening before meeting Kamala. And, but then it doesn't stay. It's not like, you know, enlightenment of stream entry or full enlightenment. It kind of retrogresses, you know, when he kind of degrades when he's living in the city. But he does leave the city. He does go the path of sensuality and yeah, kind of comes back and lives a more simple life just living with the fairy person, the ferryman. And I think
it's true.
And so he does, I mean,
he does see past that.
He sees past it. But there is also, I mean, Narcissus and Goldman, I think you've mentioned that you had a special relationship with that. And then, so in that, and I won't try to pick out which one of us is Narcissus and which one is Goldman, but I mean, Goldman is kind of this hero who's, the man of the world and can do both sensuality and spiritual depth and maturity.
Yeah, I mean, the final line of Narcissus and Goldman is, how can you, he's talking to Goldman, who's the kind of sensualist who wanders through the world, returns and talks to Narcissus and says, how can you live if you don't know your mother? How can you die if you don't know your mother? And
Narcissus being like this monastic.
Saying like, look, this dry asceticism isn't, where's your heart? And you know, I think Hesse is touching such a poignant chord there that I have seen as an issue with Theravada practitioners and Buddhist practitioners, where you don't know your mother, like in the sense that archetypal sense of grace, of kindness, of kind of nourishment of the heart. So he's getting at something. You're right. And I think a lot of even Siddhartha's path goes through that realm of at least knowing that part of himself. But there's also a limit to how far it goes. What other thoughts do you have on the kind of landscape of those, that book?
Well, just in terms of what, one thing I found interesting was what Hermann Hesse would have had access to. I mean, now we're swimming in the polycanon, you know, multiple translations, Sutta Central, Access to Insight. The Buddha, Buddhism, Theravada Buddhism has even come to the West. It's been translated into English for, started in the late 1800s. Now we've got monastic teachers establishing monasteries in the Theravada tradition in America for several decades now. So we've got a lot. There's less excuse for us to be somewhat naive about what the actual Buddha was teaching. And here, again, it's somewhat confused. I think a number of people might be confused that, you know, because Siddhartha was the name of the Buddha, that maybe this is purporting to be some kind of biography of the Buddha, which it's definitely not. But, you know, Hermann Hesse, you know, was living, he was born in 1877. Jnana Tiloka, actually the famous German monk ordained in Sri Lanka, actually went to Sri Lanka, you know, to ordain, was, 15 or 20 years before Siddhartha was written. He had created was the president of the German Pali Society. Danish-German author Carl Gjellerup, who also won a Nobel Prize and wrote The Pilgrim Camenita. Mm. I mean, that was published 10 or 20 years.
That's an amazing book if you haven't read it, by the way, The Pilgrim Camenita, yes.
And yeah, The Pilgrim Camenita, kind of re-edited by Adrian Amaro, who has a foreword to it. That was written or released 10 or 20 years before, or around that, before Siddhartha. So Hermann Hesse, you know, had some access. There was, Jan Tilke was doing translation, so he did have access to some level of translation, but it wasn't as wide as now. But one other interesting contemporary was Ajahn Mun. So he never met Ajahn Mun, of course, but Ajahn Mun was born in 1870. And so when Siddhartha came out in 1922, Ajahn Mun would have been 52. And I just had the thought, would Ajahn Mun have been impressed if Siddhartha had been translated into Thai?
He was visited by a bunch of German devas in his biography. I don't know how he knew they were German, but it's in the book. It's in the book.
Interesting. But I don't think that Ajahn Mun would have been impressed.
Yeah. No, I think you bring up some really, not just what he had access to, but like what was in the moment. And Ajahn Tanisaro has a really great essay, which we've both read, called Buddhist, The Roots of Buddhist Romanticism. And it really points to how like our, and you can, you know, flesh out my summary of it, but how our conception of Buddhism in the US has been really influenced by German Romanticism, which is this rebellion against like the Enlightenment and Industrial Revolution, where, you know, this focus on merging with the all, nature, non-dual, this emphasis on individual experience was really primary. And you really see this language in modern Buddhist circles of interconnectedness, of kind of dancing with samsara even as you're in it. And you know, first, yes, if you go straight to the Buddha's words, he really was talking about pulling back from sensuality. And it strikes me as unfair that Hesse and Jack Kerouac and all these people had to write without having met people who've really embodied this path, and to see like it doesn't manifest as this kind of dry asceticism. It's you know, people who have, the people I've met who I believe have had jhana or some level of deep awakening, they're just radiant. And there's no way you could, you know, draw that dichotomy between the kind of dry ascetic and you know, loving sensualist after you've met someone who has those states, you know. And and yet they didn't have access to that. And also to acknowledge, like, I think there is a reason the non-dual teachings always kind of are hovering below the surface of any moment in spiritual trajectory, because there is something important after you kind of read the Buddhist teachings on pulling back from certain things, or the dichotomy of coming back to rest in what our life is, which is kind of messy. And it's, you know, I understand why those teachings remain. So just to say, I do still love this book. It's just, yeah, I think there is something not articulated in it, which is really key. And I think there's been a moment with the Theravada and Buddhism in the US now where there's like an opening for these more, for the teachings that have some teeth, you know? So yeah, what were your thoughts on all that? The jhana, everything, et cetera.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, beautifully said. And I agree. Like, it's a good book. Listened to it twice in the last month.
It's a good book.
It's a good book. It's a good book, but it's not Theravada Buddhist. Mm. It's not presenting Buddhism as Siddhartha Gautama in the Pali Canon kind of reveals it. Towards the end of the book, you know, there are these statements, samsara and nirvana are one, which do come up and talk about interbeing. You know, that does come up in later Mahayana texts, but it's not so much in line with the Pali teachings. It's not in line with the Pali teachings, where transcendence is something totally different. That essay that you mentioned by Tanisiro Bhikkhu is actually expanded into a full book called Buddhist Romanticism, which is also available for free. But yeah, therein Ajahn Jeff goes into 20 different Buddhist romantic beliefs based on the German romantics, Hölderlin, Novalis, both of which, Hesse, Hesse was reading and studying. And yeah, how these 20 different beliefs of Buddhist romanticism that are not really in line with Theravada Buddhism, like that the point of a spiritual life is to merge with the universe, that the erotic path of sex is a path that will lead to that goal. Yeah, it's a different goal. It's a different path between these two different visions. And yeah, it's a neat book. It's engaging. There is some wisdom in there. I think you had a quote that you brought up that you highlighted about the river being timeless. But yet, it's the Buddhist path is it has an end. The Theravada Buddhist path, and it's much more clear.
Yeah, that's great. And people should feel free to type questions or things they'd like to talk about as well as we kind of wrap up here. But no, I think there's so many notes of real truth in it. Like just the moment at the beginning where Siddhartha, he's this rich, wealthy, handsome Brahmin, and he stands by his father asking to go forth until his father lets him. And he said, you know, his father doesn't want to let him go. And he says, you will wait, Siddhartha. And he says, I will wait. I think he says, give up, Siddhartha. He says, I will give up. I will not give up. You will die, Siddhartha. I will die. Like just saying he will not budge until he's allowed to go forth. And that movement of someone giving up even the apex of a worldly life for the renunciant, it's my heart just leaps at that. And I think I just think people can't help but be moved by those visions of, because there's a profound truth there. And he does articulate these archetypal paths of the renunciant and the world. And in the end, he does try to dissolve them into one. And I can't imagine him being able to do much better than he did, given the teachings he had and the experiences he had. And you're right. Like, I think there's a limit to that way of articulating, no matter how powerful it is to read, you know. But it did spur me to search, and sounds like to you to some extent as well. So
yeah, and you're totally right. I mean, he didn't have good, you know, many, if any. He did in 1911, you know, go on this trip to Asia. He went to Malaysia and Sri Lanka. I don't think he even made it to India, but you know, he was unimpressed with the monastics that he met in Sri Lanka. It was basically just formal. Formal Buddhism, and he was so unimpressed by it. But he also had this artistic bent that he really, I think, luxuriated in the archetype of being an artist, and saw that, you know, there's a famous letter he wrote to his mother where he says that the virtue of an artist is aesthetics. I think he could have found that there is, you know, a different path in Buddhism, and chose to take this other one. I do have one question for you. What are the three things that Siddhartha could do?
Oh, he could wait, he can think, and he can fast.
That's right. Isn't that cool?
Yeah, it's so good.
I think that's many people's takeaways.
Yeah. No, you said that well. And I do know one person who would consistently mistake the five ascetics for the five aesthetics, which is somewhat resonant in Buddhist thought. But yeah, and also to say that, you know, I appreciate the clear lines that Theravada gives us and the Vinaya, you know, and I think this wave, the first wave of Buddhism in the West, really was delighting in this, you know, the wisdom, elements of non-dual, and only with the coming of the Vinaya, the code of conduct, did really this container for all that wisdom come along. And I think that was an essential element. I mean, you only have to look at the kind of the bloodbath of scandal in the first 50 years of Buddhism in America to see its usefulness of having codes of conduct and sila stressed, but also I really do see, you know, how Westerners are already so harsh with themselves. They take the admonitions to renunciation sometimes so unskillfully and so harshly. I can understand why there's always this thread of kind of non-dual, of allowing the world to be as it is, as you exist in it, not thinking you need to change your whole life to practice, because that's not wholesome either. So I see the medicine that people also gather from Siddhartha, but yeah, it's not the whole regimen, you know?
Yeah. I saw in one thread, this question: is Siddhartha Buddhist? Mm. And someone responding, a bunch of people responding, you know, no, it's not. But then someone saying, oh yeah, yeah, it is. You know, it's really in line with this, you know, and they quoted the Kalama Sutta, that don't go by scriptural collection. Don't go by hearsay. Don't go by lineage. Don't go by scriptural collection. Don't go by reasoning. Mm. So yeah, that's what Siddhartha doing. He was like the best at that. He was foremost. He met the Buddha even, and they quote, you know, that the book, which I read and I think I liked at the time, if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him, which is not a Buddhist concept. And we don't advocate that. But yeah, what do you think about this path of like radical inquiry? Don't take anybody for a teacher. Only you can be your own teacher.
No, it's a great question. And the Kalama Sutta, for those of you who don't know, it's really the Buddha working to answer the doubts of the Kalamas around a bunch of different teachings they've been hearing. And the parts that gets quoted all the time is, you know, when you know for yourself, these things are unskillful, these things are skillful, etc. Give them up or take them on. But what always gets left out is the second part, where he says, also, what's censured and praised by the wise? Like, because we can't always trust ourselves. And also, we don't have to go down every false path if there's wise. So it just would have been probably healthy for young Siddhartha to like spend more than a night with the Buddha, because if you want to find the wise, it's kind of, that's your guy, and that's your teacher. I think there's a romantic edge to that. And I think American culture as a whole, I really sense it, there's a liminal point right now where people are ready for, they've seen part of the limits of that way of thinking, you know, like it's played out. They've heard a lot of these teachings and they want to be pushed on sila. They want to be pushed on renunciation. They want to train. And like, I think that American Buddhism's at that moment right now. So yeah, any thoughts?
Yeah, just one, maybe before we go into reading some people's thoughts and questions, I found a book of his fairy tales. He's got, you know, several dozen of these, and one of them is called Augustus, and it's the story of this boy. And when he's, you know, when he's a young baby, the mother gets a wish from this fairy godfather, and she wishes, may everyone love him. And he goes through his life and everyone loves him, and he becomes really corrupt. Mm. He becomes a womanizer. He like takes on all this debt, and still everybody loves him, even though he's a huge jerk. And then he kind of sees through all of that, that it doesn't actually make him happy. Mm. And then he finally meets the fairy godfather again. And I think he's about to commit suicide. The book is called Short Stories, Augustus. Mm. And the fairy godfather gives him one more wish, and his wish is, rather than what his mother wished for him, may everyone love my son. Mm. He changed it to, may I love everyone. And then, so everybody, all of his, you know, debtors, you know, all the people who he owed money to, and all the women who he had corrupted, and all these things, they hate him. They can see through it. They no longer love him. But even as they're beating him, he loves them. Mm. And that leads to happiness.
Kind well, of well done, Hess.
Yeah, well done, Hess. All right.
Thanks, Sasha. So we'll take questions from the chat. If people would like to discuss anything, either related to the book or just life in general, then you can type it. One person asked what the title was of the Pilgrim Caminita. Just to give a little clarity, that was written at the start of the century by another Nobel Prize winner. And it's a story based in the time of the Buddha. It was forgotten largely in the Western world, but it became more or less required reading in Thailand for about a century. And Ajahn Amaro, I think, rediscovered it, and they edited the new translation, and you can find it for free on Amaravati's website. Just Google The Pilgrim Kamanita. It's really quite beautiful, even though it's, you know, it's a love story, but it's pretty great.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Yeah. By Carl Gjellerup, and we didn't look up how to pronounce that.
I read that Hermann Hesse traveled to India as a young man. Does anyone know if he ever met the Indian Bengali polymath Rabindranath Tagore?
He did not actually make it to India. He wrote a book, Journey to the East, but he only made it as he made it to Sri Lanka and Malaysia, but not to India, if I'm correct.
I would argue that Hesse, Kerouac, Wolfe, etc. had plenty of access to models of asceticism and renunciation of sensuality through the teachings of Jesus and Socrates thousands of years ago.
Good point.
Yeah, and you know, I think what I meant, here we go. Sensuality blocks our ability to appreciate renunciation and impairs our thinking in this way. So I would agree that they had access to examples of it. Just personally, from my experience, there's something really particularly impactful about meeting someone who's not just cultivated asceticism, but where you see this luminosity of the spirit that comes from, you know, deep access to concentration and liberation of heart, that I, you know, I don't think would always shine through as much in old texts. And I know for me, yeah, that was important to see in person before I felt like I had any inkling of what would replace sensuality when it was stepped back from a bit. Arjun, what would you say to that?
Yeah, very much that. And I believe Hess did go to a seminary, or he went to some kind of religious school. And I mean, leave it up to an elementary school to get you uninspired by
different. Yeah, he didn't have a good experience there, did he?
I don't believe so. Yeah, he was became quite depressed, actually.
And for those who don't know, there's a decent Ajahn Sona, and I think we did an interview with him, has decent evidence that Socrates had access to significant states of jhana, perhaps, as well. Ajahn Kovilo, I recall that you recommended Open Heart, Open Mind by Sokni Rinpoche. I'm reading this now and find it fascinating. Siddhartha didn't touch me so much, however, Narcissus Goldman really rocked me. It's been a signpost for me.
Someone else said that I recommended Open Heart, Open Mind, which if I did, it was sort of an accident. I haven't yet read that, but I did read Carefree Dignity, which is amazing. But I'm glad you're enjoying Open Heart, Open Mind. I think I'll read that next as well. I've just read his Why We Meditate with Daniel Goldman, just finished the whole book, and just a couple of days, but that's great too.
One thing that's sort of coming up, and people feel free to post anything else in the chat. You spoke briefly, and I'm curious about your impression of his eventual, Siddhartha's eventual enlightenment at the river. But it is this merging with all beings. And it's really interesting in the suttas when the Buddha talks about giving up, like how we impute a self into reality. He talks about how we posit a self in regard to the body, taking the body as form, forms in the body. And he does that with all the aggregates. And then he goes on and says, or one thinks this this consciousness or this awareness, that which is sensitive here and now, will last as long as eternity and all-encompassing, basically. Like, this too is another sense of self. And so it's very interesting that he actually points to that idea of merging with the all, and points to how even that can become a focal point of the self. I don't know if you remember the exact quote in the suttas, but it's, I was reading it recently, and it's, you know, it's, I think there's probably ways of holding that idea of dissolving into nirvana that are really, you know, more accurate, but he speaks to that.
Is it maybe Dikkanikaya number one?
It might be. It appears in a few places in the Samyutta as well. But
so the end, I don't want to do a spoiler.
But, it's okay. He You can do it.
Yeah. Well, there comes to be this kind of apotheosis, which is kind of a deification when somewhat similar to what happens with Arjuna seeing the body of Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, where basically there's a moment of this realization where Arjuna, Krishna's kind of charioteer, sees the full Krishna for what Krishna is, and Krishna is like everything and everybody and the God of huge, basically divine with a capital, super capital, bold, D. And that is something happens in that direction with Govinda and Siddhartha. You know, I could read that quote that you had from about time, or?
Yeah, there's one other thing I thought I'd speak on, and feel free to post any questions, people. But just the fact that
now it's gone. You read the quote. Okay, please jump in if I. So this is Siddhartha talking about the river. Have you also learned that secret from the river, that there is no such thing as time? That the river is everywhere at the same time, at the source and at the mouth, at the waterfall, at the ferry, at the current, in the ocean and in the mountains, everywhere, and that the present only exists for it, not the shadow of the past, nor the shadow of the future. It's interesting that, you know, the Buddha's image of a raft is different from what we find in Siddhartha. You know, the raft is the path, and we take it to get from here to the far shore, and it's not kind of a ferrying back and forth. You know, it's even when people take the simile further than the Buddha did say, when you get to the other shore, you can leave the raft there and then, you know, do as you're on the other shore. But it's that it doesn't have the same effect of like going back and forth, because one, in Theravada Buddhism, nirvana isn't a place. So it's not like you've left everybody behind, and this is oftentimes not really understood. But also it's, you don't destroy the path. You couldn't destroy the path, but you don't disrespect the path, that you don't flaunt the path. You know, it's said that a stream enter, someone who's fully entered the stream and won't regress, can't basically break precepts. They won't do sexual misconduct or lie or steal or kill. I hadn't really realized that, but it's a different metaphor of the boat, but somewhat similar of time.
Well, no, it's a good point. And the ferryman goes from one shore to the other, which is very much what kind of Siddhartha is, in some sense, the short sensuality and renunciation back and forth and back and forth. And eventually the river is where he lands, which is a place of no landing almost. And for the Buddha, there is a landing place. And it's, I remember seeing, comparing the shrines of Hinduism in India to the shrines, the Buddhist shrines. And the Hindu shrines are often centered around a river. There's this fluidity and movement, this life that's kind of coming in and out. And the Buddhist stupas were these pure, clean, centered, static places, in the sense of symmetrical in a different way. And these are broad strokes, not kind of saying too much about any religion, just to say that, in Buddhism, there's an end point, and it's not of this world.
There's also that, as you're mentioning it, I mean, the different mudras that were refined over the course of history in both Hinduism and Buddhism. They don't really occur in the same way in the Pali texts, but there is one in modern day Thailand and probably in other Buddhist countries of this one, of Buddha standing with his hands like this, and it's called Stopping the Ocean. Pointing to a time when the Buddha stopped this rivalry between this basically war in his home country, and there was some kind of body of water that he stopped. And it's just pointing to this. There is an end, and Yeah, it's not a continual
birth. At Wat Pa Pong, the main Buddha image usually would have one hand up to stop. But the one at Wat Pa Pong, Ajahn Chah's monastery, had two hands up. And people asked Ajahn Chah why it had that. And he said, oh, people these days, they need two hands to stop them. So, can something last as long as eternity? Softball there. Ajahn?
Well, timelessness, I mean, it's fascinating, this word. So there are six epithets or other names for, or different angles on the Dhamma. So when we chant the praise of the Dhamma every time, the Dhamma is well expounded by the Blessed One, apparent here and now, timeless, encouraging investigation, leading inwards to be experienced individually by the wise. I didn't do that.
Right over my face.
Timeless. It's timeless. Yeah. But basically that second one, akaliko, is both, literally means timeless. And in a sense, like if there's no time, then that moment, the present moment, is eternity. And that's kind of what Govinda sees in the apotheosis of Siddhartha. And yeah, on Nibbana is used that epithet, akaliko, timeless, is also used for Nibbana.
Yeah, I mean, and one interesting point to tag on there is, the framework of time just, I think, breaks down when you talk about the unborn. The opposite of anicca, impermanence, would be nicca, which means permanent or lasting. When the Buddha referred to Nibbana, he didn't call it nicca. He called it unborn, the amata, the deathless, akaliko, timeless. So, it was another dimension. Then you get into these interesting non-dual things, acknowledging that there's, our samsara and nibbana the same thing, etc. I think from the Buddhist perspective, he drew he was very clear that this is something beyond time. And as to if samsara itself is eternal, the Buddha said there's no discernible beginning. And I think that's a very interesting use of the phrasing, but he sort of said that really trying to speculate about the beginning or end of the universe was fruitless and your head would explode. It's one of the things you shouldn't think about. Imponderables. And just to say, like, in the Western tradition, we do have, if you read Socrates and the philosophers near Plato were filtered through an Enlightenment lens, and many of us read them that way. But if you read them with a Buddhist eye, you really see that there's a good chance Socrates really did have these deep states of concentration. There's stories of him standing outside in the cold for hours. And they believed in rebirth. The philosopher kings could very much be looked at as bodhisattvas, but it was, a lot of those Pythagoras and stuff. So the person who pointed out that the Western lineage does have these ascetics, in some sense it's true. I just feel like we've lost them for about, quite a long time, at least in the US.
Maybe this will be our last question. I'm so, so grateful for this discussion. And this will be the last one. I have been concerned that Hess's novel misleads people about the Dharma.
What are your thoughts on that, Ajahn?
I would highly recommend this book, Buddhist Romanticism. Mm-hmm. Tanisaro Bhikkhu does such a good job of, he only mentions Hess once, and that's like in the introduction or the preface. But really, Hess was highly influenced by these other Buddhists, by these German Buddhists or these German Romantics. Mm-hmm. And pretty much every point in this list of 20 philosophies of German Romanticism, he kind of goes one for one, saying how they compare with Buddhism. So the whole book is kind of in that trajectory. Like, it actually could be dangerous, if you take some lesser thing for the highest goal, then you might stop short. And if samsara is real, which the Buddha says it was, then who knows what you'll be next life, and if you'll have as good a chance for awakening next life.
No, I really appreciate, like, that is a good book to give. If you give people a copy of Siddhartha, you should also give them a copy of Buddhist Romanticism.
Nice.
And and yet it's also interesting that, like, Siddhartha Hess articulated that search better than almost, in some ways, anyone I know. And I mean, so many people have read him, and it's been their spur to spiritual search. So I think we can also feel a lot of gratitude for that. And yeah, I know a few people who've gotten into robes through that. One watched The Matrix and then ordained, but we might save that for a different live stream. We should wrap stuff up though. So I'll paste the Zoom link for those who want to join us for our Wednesday evening discussion. We'll open that Zoom room in a second. And otherwise, just very grateful for this community. We love actually getting to speak with everyone here. And Ajahn, it's a pleasure.
Yeah,
any
it's great
final
to
thoughts?
Or narcissism in Goldman is really good as well.
I love it. All right. Take care, everyone.